Chapter 8. German Restraint. The Russian leaders had in the beginning believed, with no small naivete, that their mobilization could be carried out in secret, affording their lumbering armed forces a week or so extra in which to assemble the millions of draftees and march them to the German and Austrian frontiers. Within 24 hours the word was out, scattered to the four winds. The indiscretions had been numerous, from Grunwald's hint to the German von Chilius at the banquet at Krasnoye Selo to Izvolsky's indiscreet behavior at the railway station. The newly commissioned young officers from the military academy were less than reticent, and Grand Duke Nicholas, his chest puffed out, was already playing the braggart soldier to the admiring ladies of the Russian capital. As the Bolsheviks were to demonstrate by their publication of the Russian diplomatic archives concerning Franco-Russian relations between 1910 and 1914, the Tsarist regime continued to mistrust its French allies down to the very outbreak of the war. The offer of so much French gold and blood, in addition to the Tsar's gaining mastery of Constantinople, the Balkans, Ruthenia, those parts of Poland in German and Austrian hands, and Bohemia as well, struck the Russians as generous indeed, even if compensated for by the rerun to France of Alsace-Lorraine. To make sure that France would not at the last moment withdraw from her commitments, the Russians speeded up mobilization to the best of their abilities. The faster they moved, the more certain France's cooperation, but all the more likely that word would reach the Panslavists' prospective enemies. And already suspicion was rising across the border, in Germany. On July 25, Kaiser Wilhelm was still at sea aboard his yacht Hohenzollern, unaware of the Russian decision to mobilize and the Serbian rejection of Austria's demands. In Berlin, the German government was beginning to receive disquieting news from St. Petersburg. Before that, Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg had been slow to credit the Russian involvement in the grisly affair at Sarajevo. Although aware of Russian machinations in the Balkans, it seemed to him inconceivable that the Tsar would make common cause with regicides. It was his predecessor, Prince Bernhard von Bülow, who opened his eyes on this matter. With malicious delight, von Bülow recounted the story of how in 1814 Tsar Alexander I had urged Louis XVIII to find a job for Savary. The king had said that that was quite impossible, since Savary had sat on the revolutionary tribunal which had sentenced Louis XVI to the guillotine. "Is that all?" exclaimed the Tsar, "and I dine every day with Bennigsen and Uchikov who strangled my father." At the beginning of July 1914, Bethmann Hollweg had been present at a conversation between the Kaiser and his Minister of War, General Falkenhayn. The general had asked, "Is it necessary to begin any sort of military preparations?" As we have seen, the Kaiser answered in the negative, "I am completely opposed to that," adding, "Have a nice summer," after which he sent his minister off to the country. As Prince von Bülow was later to relate, on the next day, just as he, the Kaiser, was about to leave for Kiel and his cruise to the north, he received representatives of the Army and Navy General Staffs and informed them that Austria was going to demand an accounting from Serbia for the Sarajevo murder, but that there was no reason to fear a serious conflict, and it was hence unnecessary to begin military or naval preparations. To be sure, blustering as was his habit, Wilhelm II had fired off a broadside of bad names at the Serbs and expressed the wish that Serbia be soundly thrashed for its crime. Nevertheless, he had made clear that punishment was entirely the business of the Austrians. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg was a good deal less warlike than even his sovereign. Even after he received word that Poincaré was heading for Russia, and was informed of the French press's far from hostile coverage of the Sarajevo assassins, he did nothing. Sitting alone sphinx-like in his Berlin office, he kept silent, reading his Plato, secure in his belief that the war, if it broke out, would be confined to the Balkans. Nevertheless, some German officials became apprehensive early in July. Count Waddell, a counselor to the political section of the Foreign Affairs Ministry, telephoned Berlin from Norderney in the East Frisian Islands, where he was vacationing, to ask if he should return to his post. He was told that his vacation need not be interrupted, it was only a false alarm, and everything would be all right. State Secretary Delbruck, also on vacation, grew apprehensive 10 days after Sarajevo. On July 9 he returned to Berlin, and suggested to Bethmann Hollweg that it might be wise to set in motion the contingency measures that had been formulated several years before in the event of a threat of war. The measures include big purchases of grain on the Rotterdam Exchange, and Delbruck urged this with particular insistence. Indeed, the French had begun stockpiling flour as early as January 1914, with special funds provided by the military. Bethmann Hollweg remained calm in the face of Delbruck's entreaties. For Germany to perform the slightest action which could be taken as a preparation for war would be out of the question, he replied. Still worried, Delbruck had taken his case to the foreign minister, Gottlieb von Jago, and then the treasury secretary, Kuhn. He was rebuffed each time, and finally ordered to resume his vacation. He wouldn't return until almost 2 weeks later. It was Montaigne who wrote, "All the troubles in this world arise from stupidity," yet Theobald von Bethmann Hollweg was not a stupid man. Fluent in the classical languages, a lover of Beethoven, he was a very capable administrator, with a genius for paperwork. In the tangled thicket of intrigue which surrounded the Sarajevo affair, however, he was completely lacking in astuteness. Indulgent toward Austria-Hungary, he imagined that her leaders would restrain their indignation and, if they couldn't work out a settlement with Serbia, at least confine themselves to a war limited in area and aim. Doubtless he should have made very clear to the Austrian government that Germany, sympathetic as she was to Austria's outrage, would not allow herself to be dragged into a war over Sarajevo. Bethmann Hollweg should have communicated the fact that the Kaiser's sympathy was that of a friend and of a monarch, not that of a warlord or a geopolitician seeking to alter fundamentally the borders and power relationships in any part of Europe, including the Balkans. Yet the German Chancellor let things slide during the vital first 3 weeks in July. The Austrians prepared their ultimatum, and the Germans, neither distancing themselves from it nor supporting it, likewise neither prepared for war nor for peace. The revelation provided von Chilius by Baron Grunwald on July 25 struck the Chancellor's office like a bomb. More bad news poured in. German sentries on the East Prussian border reported the Russians tearing down their customs buildings and uprooting barrier fences. From St. Petersburg came further word of military preparations underway in Kiev and Kharkov. Grand Duke Nicholas had paraded his cavalry from Krasnoye Selo through St. Petersburg. The 16 squadrons of guards, Cossacks, cuirassiers, and dragoons in full battle array made a fearsome sight, and the thousands of trotting hooves, the bugle fanfares, and the glittering regimental colors stirred the hearts of the St. Petersburgers and the fears of the foreigners, at least those who were diplomats from countries less than enthusiastic about Russian imperialism. Germany's ambassador, Count Portales, paid a call on Sazonov. "You are continuing to arm?" inquired the German diplomat. "Just some preparatory measures, in order not to be caught short." "It's not a question of mobilization," responded Sazonov. "Such measures are extremely dangerous." "I fear they may provoke countermeasures from the other side," retorted the German. In a few hours, news of this conversation was contributing to the growing furor in Berlin. Bethmann Hollweg was panic-stricken when he realized that the enormous Russian Empire was readying for war. Galvanized to action at last, on July 26 he sent a telegram to his ambassador in London, Prince Lichnowsky, instructing him to call on Britain's foreign minister, Sir Edward Grey, and ask him to intervene immediately with St. Petersburg against a Russian mobilization in any form. Bad show, Sir Edward had gone fishing that Sunday. It was the season when the trout were at their fattest and most beautiful. Grey had once written, "For myself I know nothing which equals the excitement of having hooked an unexpectedly large fish on a small rod and a fine tackle." Prince Lichnowsky caught nothing that day. He was forced to wait until Monday to convey his chancellor's message. At the same time, another fisherman was spending the last few hours of his yachting vacation at sea. Kaiser Wilhelm was worried and angry. He considered the actions, or lack of action, of his chancellor deplorable. He had finally been notified of the developing crisis, but he still awaited the text of Serbia's reply to Austria. Vienna had tarried a day after receiving the note before informing Berlin of its content. Von Jago, the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, would only see the text on July 27, 2 days after it was delivered to Vienna. Wilhelm II landed at Kiel on the 27th, and arrived in Potsdam on his special train several hours later. There he met the hapless Bethmann Hollweg and favored him with a withering glare. The Chancellor, stammering in confusion, offered his resignation on the spot. The Kaiser coldly refused it. "You have cooked this broth. Now you are going to eat it," he told Bethmann Hollweg. The next morning Kaiser Wilhelm had his first look at the text of the Serbian reply, at 7 o'clock in the morning. He was not overly dismayed, he believed that the assassins had to be found and punished, but it still didn't seem as if war were inevitable. He learned that the British were considering proposing that the Austrians occupy Belgrade until the crisis was resolved. Far-fetched as that may have seemed, it still offered hope that a solution short of all-out combat might be found. There seemed an additional ray of hope from Vienna. Kaiser Franz Joseph had let fall a remark which seemed to hold open a possibility for peace. After all, the Habsburg had said, breaking off diplomatic relations doesn't have to be a casus belli. Kaiser Wilhelm took just an hour to work out a plan for a provisional peace between Austria and Serbia, along the lines of the thinking in the British Foreign Office. After a horseback ride in the park, he returned to his desk to write down his proposal in more definite form. It called for a temporary occupation of Belgrade by the Austrians, to ensure the good faith of the Serbs in rooting out the conspiracy that had murdered Wilhelm's friend the Archduke.